Scooter Pie is, at about 10 cents a serving, a delicious and economical family dessert. 11 heavenly bites of fun. That's Scooter Pie. Big chocolatey bites. Gobs of marshmallow. Now in three fun flavors. Vanilla marshmallow. Cherry marshmallow. Banana marshmallow. Save 20 cents on Burry Scooter Pies. The marshmallow treat that's a favorite with kids of all ages. Finding a cake that you can eat like a cookie is as easy as Scooter Pie. Take a creamy marshmallow center, surround it with vanilla-flavored or devil's food cakes. Top it off with a thick, rich, chocolatey coating. What have you got? A cake you can eat like a cookie. Scooter Pie. Call it a cake, cookie, or pie. The decision is up to you. Decide for yourself, ask your mom, or even the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. A Scooter Pie is so much fun to eat, you'll definitely call for more. Good day, I'm Stephen Goldman, host of the Infinite Inning Podcast. As I come to you now, we are just past Mardi Gras 2023, which makes it a good time to talk about Scooter Pie. As I just related to you, a cake or a cookie, it was a bit confused about its identity. Its indeterminate nature was, as you heard, a high point of the advertising, and it was reportedly named for former Yankee shortstop Phil the Scooter Rizzuto. Just as Babe Ruth had no relationship with the Baby Ruth candy bar, and the Baby Ruth people explicitly denied such a connection so they could exploit the babe without paying him, I don't think that Phil Rizzuto had the slightest connection to those little single-serve babies, which not only ripped him off, if that were indeed the connection, but moon pies as well, which greatly predated both, well, Phil Rizzuto and the Scooter Pie. I should clarify that Scooter Pies and Phil Rizzuto, the human being, came along in the same year, 1917. Scooter Pie, the major leaguer, showed up about 23 years after that. Moon pies originated in Chattanooga, Tennessee. They are close to how Scooter Pies describe themselves. These are still around. A sandwich of graham crackers and marshmallow dipped in chocolate. And since each is wrapped in its own little plastic packet, it has somehow become traditional to wing them at spectators from atop a Mardi Gras float. And if you know anything about Mardi Gras debauchery, this is possibly the most wholesome aspect of Mardi Gras that we can talk about here. When I was a young kid, my grandmother would sometimes have Scooter Pies in the house for me when I came to visit. I had no conception of moon pies, which were not distributed in the Northeast at that time. And although I did have an awareness from a pretty early age of Phil, holy cow, Rizzuto, ubiquitous as he was in my part of the world, I certainly didn't make the Scooter Pie, Scooter Rizzuto connection, which now does seem a bit dubious. The timing seems wrong. It's kind of the Baby Ruth story backwards. The Baby Ruth candy bar was first marketed in 1921, when Babe Ruth was a couple of years at least into being the biggest thing in baseball and one of the biggest things in American culture, in American popular culture. When Babe Ruth's representatives said, hey, wait a minute, we would like some money for this unauthorized usage of our guy's name, the manufacturer, the Curtis Candy Company, which has now vanished into multinational food Death Star Nestle, said, we don't owe you nothing, bub. It's named after Grover Cleveland's daughter, who was conveniently dead, as was Grover himself. By then, 13 years in a box in lovely downtown Princeton, New Jersey. The poor daughter only made it to her 12th birthday due to the diphtheria bacillus. If you ever fantasize about living in an earlier, simpler time, which I think we all do now and again, recall to yourself the words, no antibiotics. Take the key out of the time machine and stay put. Thanks to a perfectly lovely diphtheria vaccine that's been around about 100 years now, this little bastard is barely known in the United States these days, but we're smarter now and no longer trust vaccines, so it's probably due for a comeback any minute now. So back to the good old days when sixth graders beat their 60-something dads to the graveyard. Yes, Ruth Cleveland licked her much older father in that race, which no one wants to win. You can visit Ruth in Princeton as well. Very same spot. Miss Ruth had been gone for 17 years as of 1921. And as I said, Grover had checked out as well. Ruth's mom, Grover's much younger wife, Frances, was still around, but she tried to keep a low profile and, as far as I know, didn't say much of anything at all. So basically, if you and I started a candy company and marketed something called the Trout Bar or the Oh Tawny, and then claimed that it was not named after one of those Angels ball players, but was somehow associated with some person who had passed on in 2006, Jack Palance, Gerald Ford, Saddam Hussein, yum, I would like another Saddam Hussein, please, it would be just as plausible. Yeah, we go around all the time naming candy bars after dead children. Or dead anyone, really. Would you like a chunky Lucretia Borgia? It's chock full of raisin nuts and incest. Oh boy, it's Halloween. The first trick-or-treaters are here. Here you go, kids. One crispy Nixon for each of you. Of course, it wouldn't be named after Richard Nixon because he had a full life. It would have been named after one of his brothers, like Arthur, who checked out at age 7. It's a baby Artie. It tastes like lemon peel, gasoline, and tuberculosis. Now, no doubt Phil Rizzuto was still au courant as of the Scooter Pie's birth, which was about 1959. But at that point, he was 3 years into his broadcasting career and 6 years past his last All-Star game. He was a popular, much-loved personality in this part of the world for the rest of his life, so it's not crazy that some New Jersey-based baking company, which is what Burry was at the time, would land on a Phil Rizzuto-associated name that they didn't have to pay for to market their Moon Pie ripoff, but I'm kind of skeptical. Well, Phil isn't around anymore, and you can't even visit him in lovely downtown Princeton, New Jersey, the way that you can with Grover and Ruth, although he lived in the state from his playing career onwards. There used to be a billboard on Interstate 78 East, just off the Garden State Parkway, pointing out his hometown of Hillside. And after many corporate sales and mergers, Burry is long gone, and it seems like Scooter Pies are gone too. My grandmother left us a long time ago now, and I can't remember when she had last given me a Scooter Pie. Maybe she thought I had grown out of them, which is sad, because who would? When I was older, I used to take her out to a restaurant that served sushi, which is a more adult kind of food, it seems. And as someone who was born well over 100 years ago now, she used to marvel that I could eat that stuff. She did steal a little of the pickled ginger off my side of the plate, though. That wasn't as alien to her. I could go down now to New Orleans and have someone try to hit me with a moon pie, but it wouldn't be the same. Neither of us is the same now. The moon pie is not the Scooter Pie. The Scooter Pie is demised, and, well, so is my youth. And I'll tell you something else. Something brought to mind by the recent passing of Tim McCarver. By the time I was old enough to have Grandma Esther give me a Scooter Pie, the actual Scooter was about to hit his third decade in the booth, and he had long since lost interest. He actually had a notation in his scorebook, WW, which stood for wasn't watching. He wasn't unpleasant to listen to, at least not some of the time. If your expectations were that the broadcast was kind of a hangout with a dotty grandpa and not a place to hear about the game, I think we'd agree, you and I, that mostly you do want to hear about the game. That's what you're there for. You are a baseball fan. You're probably a fan of one of the two teams that you're watching, and you do want to know what's going on. But if the grandpa in question, the dotty grandpa, is, well, I was going to say avuncular enough, but that would be mixing metaphors. If he's pleasant enough, entertaining enough, if you feel an affection for Grandpa Scooter, then it's kind of okay for a while. It can wear thin over 162 games. But you understand what I'm saying. There's no right way to do a baseball game and no right way to listen to one either. There's a quote from a a David Letterman show that's in several baseball books. This was no doubt a monologue gag. He said, "I heard the doctors revived a man after being dead for 4.5 minutes. When they asked what it was like being dead, he said it was like listening to Phil Rizzuto during a rain delay." And it suggests the ephemeral nature of things we used to take for granted, laugh at, make fun of. The Dottie Grandpa. Dottie Grandpa's not here now. The 14th century Scottish poet William Dunbar wrote, and I'll do my best with this, "Our pleasance here is all vainglory. This false world is but transitory. The flesh is frail. The fiend runs free. Timor mortis conturbat me." That last Latin line, which ends each of 25 stanzas, and aren't you glad I spared you 24 and a half of them, translates to, "The fear of death disturbs me." Dunbar concludes his 25 stanzas with the thought that we have to get used to not getting used to it so that we are prepared for the inevitable and will be set free from timor mortis conturbat me. Frankly, my case, timor lunch conturbat me, so this seems like a huge ask, but I think I've got it. Maybe it's denial, but I believe one day we will all be together again, enjoying a very lengthy rain delay, Phil Rizzuto and Scooter Pies included. The people and things you once loved will again be made new. And we call that rain delay the infinite inning. Welcome back to the show. As I said earlier, my name is Stephen Goldman. That same name has been on 250 plus previous episodes of this here program. I am back with you after a vacation delay and a health delay. Unfortunately, my problems followed me out of town, so I didn't get quite the break that I was looking for, which accounts for the further delay in the resumption of our regular service schedule. As I worked up Act 1 of this show, this particular episode, I noticed this entry in an April 1977 issue of the Boston Globe. Don't worry, I won't bring back the music bed. "Down with Cherry Jello, up with Scooter Pies." That's part of the reaction of students at 4 Newton Elementary Schools, which offer hot lunches daily in interviews with food service representatives. It seems students at Bowen, Beethoven, Lincoln Elliott, and Davis generally dislike at least two of the desserts offered by the food service, Cherry Jello and Raspberry Applesauce. They wanted more desserts such as Scooter Pies, Chocolate Pudding, Twinkies, Ringdings, Cookies, and Brownies. I bet they did. I looked in vain for the follow-up article that talked about how they gave in to the students, and now there's an inexplicable diabetes outbreak in Newton, but you can rest assured that it happened. Phil Rizzuto very much did not like Casey Stengel. I don't know how Casey felt about him personally, but he was always very complimentary of his play. "What a job I've got," he said during a pregame session of fielding practice. "See that fella out at short? The fans pay to see him play, and they get their money's worth. Me, I get to watch him every day, and they pay me for it." Now, on the other hand, Phil had always been, and at that point, 7 years had gone by, this is 1956, had been an anti-Stengel guy in the clubhouse. So when Phil was 38, could no longer hit, was hurt a lot, and the Yankees wanted a roster spot for Country Slaughter in August 1956, they called Phil in, Stengel and George Weiss, and they unceremoniously released him. And he was bitter about that for the rest of his life, although they paid him for the rest of the season. The players voted him a full World Series share, and he almost literally, like a day later, went right into the broadcast booth. He had offers to play as well, I believe at least one from the Cardinals, maybe another from the Orioles, but he didn't want to do that, and that's fine. Again, he's in the Hall of Fame, and part of the reason he's in the Hall of Fame is because he He was a beloved local broadcaster. But I always wonder about how one-sided the accounts of that are. I'm not saying that Weiss and Stengel were nice about what they did or they were correct in what they did, but Rizzuto also, at least afterward, years afterward, made it pretty clear that he had no respect for those people. And he seems like a gentle guy, and he seems like a good guy, but he was also, on certain levels, an angry guy. And if they were aware of that, then why would they? If they finally had the excuse to dagger him, again, I'm not saying this is flattering. I'm not saying it's how I would have done it. I'm not saying it's a good thing. It just becomes a little more understandable when you say, well, if respect is a two-way street and he didn't act with respect, why would they have acted that way back? But it only got talked about in a one-sided way because George Weiss died in 1972, Casey died in 1975, and Rizzuto was out there every single day, every summer, for more than two decades after that. Can I give you one more dumb example of this? Somewhere towards the end of his life, Phil Rizzuto had a book, Ghosted, with his name on it, or Collaborated. However, I'm not trying to be pejorative about it, but he had a book out about the dynasty and the players who played on all five of the championship teams from 1949 through 1953. Then they took a break because Cleveland won 111 games. You know the story. And he mentions, criticizing Stengel, that in 1949, with the team having every injury known to man and some that weren't, that George Weiss in late August bought the future Hall of Fame first baseman Johnny Mize from the New York Giants. And he says this guy was really great, and he talks at great length about how Casey was an old National Leaguer and Mize was an old National Leaguer. This was something that the veteran Yankees looked down on, but that they respected each other and that Mize was perceived as Casey's guy. But then subsequently, he criticizes Stengel for not using Mize once he was acquired down the stretch in 1949. Well, of course he did, to the extent that he was able to. In fact, from the day that Mize reported, he started five of the next five games and the sixth, at which point he got hurt and disappeared for close to 3 weeks. When he came back, he wasn't really in good enough shape to do more than pinch hit. That's why he wasn't used. But that book, if it happens to be your one source on all this, and no one researches this stuff when they tell the stories. Even David Halberstam didn't fully research this stuff, and he had a huge best-selling book on the summer of 1949. That was the title, The Summer of 49. No one looks it up. No one knows. And so it's there, and just somehow, these idiots went on to win all these pennants and all these championships, even though it had nothing to do with them, and they were too dumb. They were smart enough to acquire Johnny Mize. They were smart enough to appreciate Johnny Mize on a personal basis, but they were too damn dumb to use this guy who had done things like win a couple of batting titles and hit 50 home runs in a season. You know, there are a few examples in Major League history of dumb managers who suppressed some player who might have helped their team just because of personal animus, or they misread them. Oh, I'm sure there are countless prospects who never developed because some manager decided that they just didn't like the way they looked and sent them back down, and they never got the chance to become the next Willie Mays or 10% of the next Willie Mays. And of course, we could talk about something like the Pirates in the late 1920s when Donnie Bush was managing them and he got into some pissing match, pardon the expression, with Kai Kyler about the batting order and benched him and ultimately traded him out of town to the Cubs' great benefit. I mean, those things do happen, but they happen a whole lot less often than you would think. Because just like you, just like me, managers know they need to do their job. They need the teams to perform. I was talking about 1956. I wrote that up, the 1956 Yankees, for this great team series that is still ongoing that Rob Maines and I are doing for Baseball Prospectus. And in talking about acquiring Country Slaughter, Casey Stengel talked about how he didn't need Rizzuto. What he needed was an extra outfielder because they had a whole lot of injuries and they were kind of down to Mickey Mantle, who you couldn't rely upon to stay healthy. Plus, Mickey was on his way to winning a Triple Crown. he was pretty much not replaceable. And what Stengel said, this is the way he put it, was he said, and if Mantle gets hurt, what happens to me then? And I don't think he meant, well, he could have. This is the point. I think what he meant was, how do I cope with this without replacement outfielders? And therefore, we added this 40-year-old Country Slaughter to the roster because I have to figure out how to cope with this. So don't leave me without alternatives. But you could very well read it as, what happens to me then? He's going to lose his job. In other words, because with no outfield, the Yankees, who were pretty far ahead at that point, but still are going to go 0-20 in September, 0-30 in September, and then lose the World Series once they get there. It's on the level of a Freudian slip. What happens to me then? I know he didn't say it that way. I don't have a recording. It's got to be, what happens to me then? In other words, again, how do I deal? But it works both ways. And so when someone comes back decades later and says, oh, they were so dumb, I want to see the evidence of it. Because managers, again, they are as self-protective, as CYA as anybody, and they're as lazy as anybody. They do not like to think. They do not like to make changes unless they are forced to. Most baseball moves are contingent, not voluntary. Somehow I got through that whole Scooter Pie thing without mentioning Yogi Berra's long and fruitful connection with the Yoo-Hoo chocolate drink company. In spring training of that same year, 1956, Berra handed out Yoo-Hoo business cards that said, Yogi Berra, vice president, and someone showed one to Casey, and he said, it's gratifying to know that the Yoo-Hoo people are permitting Berra to play this year with the Yankees. Nevertheless, I'm worried. Too many executives on this club. McDougal's a shoe store executive. Collins an insurance executive. And now Berra. Well, they won the World Series anyway. That was Gil McDougald and Joe Collins, just so you don't have to look it up. If only life could be so smooth that you can overcome your, well, lucrative distractions. So I do have another story for you today after the first break. I still haven't decided when we're going to get back to having conversations in the second half of the show. I suppose I've been going through some things, but right now I just want to tell stories. I assume it will change. I'm lonely for some of the guys, but I'll be honest, I've been offered some books to read lately, and I just don't want to. For the past 6 years, it's like I've been back in school reading things whether I wanted to read them or not. And sometimes, and I've complained about this to you, I know, too many times, having people just ditch, not showing up. I read the book, I take notes. People, one woman had me call her first to prove that I was worthy of interviewing her, and then never just disappeared, didn't answer my... She had agreed to do it. We had a date. She canceled on the date due to some kind of family emergency and just didn't reply to any of my follow-ups. And, you know, that was hours and days of my life. And the problem is I don't know how to do everything I want to do. I just don't know how to write the things I want to write. And I'm suddenly well into another book, not a baseball player profile book like the one I put out last summer, the Infinite Inning book, still available at Amazon and other places if you would like to read Baseball's Brief Lives. I'd very much appreciate it and enjoy hearing from you if you enjoyed it. And even if you didn't, I suppose it's out there. No, this is something very different, although it is definitely inspired by the Infinite Inning. It has grown on me in the telling, and I am now 15,000 words in. And I guess I'm obligated to finish it now. That's always the scary part, but I know I can. I've done it before. Whether anyone will want it at that point, that's a different matter and less in my control. I can only do my best. So for the time being, I'm going to weaken at some point, but I hope the program isn't too hermetic right now. You'll let me know if it is. I want to give you what you want, but I also need time to write and research, and that is the place, the editing, the recording, where someone something could give. As Kermit the Frog once sang, I am not a farmer, I can't give you a bunny. I don't know what the relevance of that is, but it felt right. I came across, honestly, I know I've said a lot about Casey, as I always do, or often do, at least, in this week's show. He was responding to reporters complaining about one of his pitchers, Johnny Sain. This would have been around 1954. And Sain wasn't very talkative, but he was a good pitcher, which is all that matters. And Casey said, now I can see where some of you fellers would like that feller to say more, because it would help you in your work. But the way he is, which, you know, shouldn't bother you, he don't say much, but it don't matter. Because when he's out there on the mound, there ain't nobody he can talk to. Out there, he's all alone. That reminded me of how the writers sometimes talk about Zach Greinke, or how they used to talk about Mike Messina. It reminded me of my current mode of podcasting. But unlike Johnny Sane, I am not alone on the mound or at the microphone, because I have you to talk with, and I hope that's all that matters. And thus, in continuing our dialogue, I have one more tale for you today, or maybe it's more of a meditation. This episode is about meditation, not in the crossing your legs in a funny way and blissing out, but in terms of deep consideration of things. At least I hope so. We're going to start with Steven Strasburg and then jet back in time as the Squid Jets, except not from some very personal orifice. I mean, you can if you want. I'm not going to shame anybody. However you listen to this show, in the privacy of your own home or automobile, join me, won't you, on the other side of this break, because I'll be there for you. To begin this segment of the show by referring to something that I have brought up before, but I haven't done it since episode 4, so I feel kind of comfortable. 247, if my math applies. You never can trust my math, but 247 episodes later, I feel okay repeating myself just slightly. In 1935, the foundational sports writer Grantland Rice, Granny to his friends, began his column with a little bit of verse. He used to do a lot of light poetry, good space filler. He tended not to write one-topic columns, but he'd do some quick hits. And if you're missing a quick hit, but you have the column inches to fill, well, why not do a little roses are red and violets are blue, that sort of thing. He was better than that. I don't know how much better. I'm not a professor of literature. I'd be curious what one would say about the accumulated poetry of Grantland Rice. I suspect you know what the answer would be. I think I do, too. It was a thing in newspapers back then, and I don't know. I mean, maybe it should have never been restricted to the Lord Byron, Percy Shelley types, but anybody could versify, and then more people would spontaneously versify even now, instead of poetry being solely a thing for aficionados, because it used to be something that everyone would read, maybe sitting around the fire. This is before radio and television, of course. Same thing with sheet music and pianos in the parlor. What shall we do tonight, Ma? Well, how about a little Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came by old Bob Browning? How about a little Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner? That ought to keep us tied up till dawn. Are you feeling frisky? Does anyone want to do Hunting of the Snark? Well, nowadays, no one reads that, and no one writes it either, or fewer people. I realize that poetry books are published all the time, but they're not going to go displacing whoever is currently at the top of the pop charts. I feel like it's a function of time, that people had the time to consider a little verse in their daily news, rather than just the who, what, where, when, why, and how, and the same thing at home. For better or worse, and sometimes it's one and sometimes it's the other, and I guess it can be both as well, our lives are made up of bulleted lists and small bites. But anyway, Granny, back in his day, I'm talking about a mere 88 years ago, took the time for rhyme. And in this instance, he topped his column with a little verse called, again, this is the bit that I've quoted before, To Any Athlete. He wrote, "Why is it each is the last to find that his legs are gone, that his eyes are bad, that the quicker reflexes have left his mind, that he hasn't the stuff that he one day had, that lost youth mocks and he doesn't see the ghost of the fellow that used to be? How can they slip from the height so far and never know that the day has gone when their eyes were fixed on a rising star with a firm foundation to stand upon? How can they slip as the comets fall and read no writing upon the wall? Caught by a stride which they used to beat, nailed by a punch that they used to block, trailing the flurry of flying feet, but dreaming still of the peaks that mock, each is the last to learn from fate that his story is finished and out of date." Here's the thing about that verse. You can find quite a bit of Granny's lyrical stuff online, by the by, especially his game called his 1948 epitaph for Babe Ruth, which is moving, but this one is hard to acquire somehow. Rice republished it in his memoirs, which I have read, but I think I must have first come across it in Bill James' 1985 Baseball Abstract, a book which sent me on my current path. Thanks, Bill. Can I say that two ways? Thanks, Bill, and also thanks, Bill. He threw it at Pete Rose, who deserved it then and would deserve it more in years to come as he selfishly kept playing past the point of all utility. And this is the thing about that poem. You can use it as a gun, as a weapon, as something to beat a player with. And I did it. I'm ashamed to admit it, but I once used it in a Baseball Prospectus annual writing about Derek Jeter. This was when Jeter was going on 37. He just hit 270 with a 340 on base percentage and a 370 slugging percentage with the range of an old Volkswagen Beetle up on blocks. And at that moment was pushing. And this did seem like a bit of hubris for a 4-year contract extension, which he got. His bat did bounce back a little after that. The defense, of course, never did. So I guess I was a little premature, although ever more balls scooted through the infield to his left. So you see, Mr. James and I use the poem cruelly, but when I look at Rice, I find his tone to generally be empathetic. This is part of the human tragedy for all of us, and he must have known that. He hit this theme multiple times, in fact. Here's another pass at it from earlier, actually, 1924, called Ghosts. This is just a piece of it. He wrote, "Men have been haunted by nameless shapes, haunted by some regret, haunted by dreams that could never come true, haunted by sin or debt, but worse than a specter out of the tomb, rougher than bitter truth, is the phantom that comes to the fading star, haunted by ghosts of youth, haunted by fiber that never tired, haunted by speed and might, the mocking voices of vanished youth whisper across the fight. The years take toll in a subtle way, wherever the road may turn, and they spread the secret among the crowd, which he is the last to learn." The foregoing was brought to mind by the struggles of Washington Nationals pitcher Steven Strasburg to return to pitching, or not just to pitching, but to pitching effectively, following thoracic outlet surgery. As you know, Strasburg was a very highly touted prospect, a rabidly touted prospect, if you will accept that, out of San Diego State University in 2009. Before that year's draft, Baseball America wrote, "In the history of the draft, no prospect has received as much pre-draft hype and publicity as Strasburg, and the attention is warranted. His combination of stuff, pitching savvy, and command make him a once-in-a-generation phenomenon. There's no doubt that Strasburg is the best college pitching prospect since Mark Pryor came out of Southern California in 2001. Pryor's career illustrates that no amateur pitcher is guaranteed long-term professional success, but Strasburg is the closest to a sure thing that scouts have ever seen." Now, as they acknowledged, Mark Pryor was an ominous comp, because Strasburg has, from the outset, been hampered by injuries. Now, he's made more than twice as many starts as Pryor did, so we needn't get too crazy with that comparison, but I think it's also fair to say that as good as Strasburg has been, the version of him that we've seen in the major leagues is not the same pitcher who the scouts were seeing when he was at San Diego State. The injuries came too quickly and too frequently for him to ever have been that guy. And so we didn't get Tom Seaver. We got a pitcher who could be Tom Seaver on any given day and was never worse than good on a seasonal basis. This is a guy with a 3.24 ERA in nearly 1,500 career innings. That's seventh among active pitchers. It's Kershaw, DeGrom, Sale, Scherzer, Cole, Verlander, and him. That is a pitcher who has nothing to alibi. That is a class photo you want to be in. But now, he's in a rough position, and it's not totally his fault. At the end of the 2019 season, he was 30, and as I said, he tended to get hurt. He had reached only 180 innings, or I should say even 180 innings, only three times, going back to 2010. He was coming off one of his best seasons, Having led the National League in wins and innings, he had struck out 251 while walking only 56. His ERA was a keen 3.32. And then he got even better in the postseason. He went absolutely nuts. He went 5-0 with a 1.98 ERA in 36 and a third innings. His strikeout ratio was an artwork-like 47-4. You will recall that the Nationals won the World Series, and he was named the series MVP. And here is where trouble ensued, because sentimentality warps judgment. He was then signed through this year, 2023, as part of a 7-year, $175 million contract extension he had signed in May 2016. It had an opt-out, and at that moment, riding high off that World Series championship and that World Series MVP, Strasburg hit the eject button. He took the option. And at that point, the Nationals, and they're not alone in this, the Nationals should have said, "Thank you so much. It's been great. Thank you for going out on such a high note," and let him move on. That's a first guess on my part. I said it at the time. I might have said it on this show. Instead, suffused with what I can only assume was maybe gratitude, although who's ever accused an owner of having that? The Nationals signed him to a new 7-year deal at $35 million a pop. He and they, this fragile pitcher who had just been pushed fairly hard, were now bound to each other through 2026 for a total of $245 million. As you well know, in the 3 years since, Strasburg has made 8 starts total, going 1-4 with a 6.89 ERA. He's had, if my count is correct, 4 60-day IL placements in that span, the scariest one being for the aforementioned thoracic outlet surgery. He'd had a lot of problems before that with things like carpal tunnel syndrome and neck and shoulder pain that it seems like, if I'm understanding correctly, originated in the problem that they tried to address with the thoracic outlet procedure. I am no doctor, just like I'm not qualified to evaluate Verse or tie a sailor's knot. However, my sense of it is that when they do this procedure, they take out a rib and other assorted accessories so as to relieve pressure on the nerve cluster known as the brachial plexus. I'm just trying to paraphrase what I have read. It's such a radical change to the body, and it forces changes to the mechanics to adjust to that. And it's hard to come back from it for that reason, because you're literally not in the same chassis that you were from your birth through puberty, through learning how to pitch, up to the moment before you had the surgery where they pulled bits of your body out and threw them in the trash. And here is where Strasburg's contract becomes a double-edged sword. Sure, it will keep him in comic books and propeller beanies for the rest of his life. Let's not knock that at all. In an age of economic insecurity, he's going to be fine, his kids are going to be fine, and very likely his grandkids are going to be fine. But even though he may be done, physically done, and eventually emotionally done, he also can't stop if he wants to get paid. He can't stop if the Nationals want to get covered by whatever insurance they had on his deal. He has to keep going, at least at some minimal level, for 4 more years. What we don't know, and we won't ever be told, is whether he wants to or not. And that gets back to the question Grantland Rice asked in To Any Athlete: why is each the last to know? Because they're not ready to know. That's all. And you can't blame them for not being ready to know. And there is some glory in pushing onward despite diminishing results. There's also pathos in it, of course. But there's also something equally wonderful in saying that you've done what you set out to do and moving on. You don't need to listen to outside definitions of greatness. It's just you and how you feel about things. Not your high school girlfriend, not your English teacher, not your mom and your dad. It's just you. And you will be the ultimate arbiter as to whether you've done enough. Their opinions don't matter. They can only live their lives, not yours. Can I give you an example of what I'm talking about? It may not be one. It may only be coincidental? I'm not sure we can know. I will leave that to you. But it's a bit like what I was talking about earlier with interpreting that one sentence that Casey spoke, the one that was a little bit like Billy Joel in The Piano Man when he sings, "I know that it's me they've been coming to see." But if he were honest about it, if he sang it properly, the way he meant it, "I know that it's me they've been coming to see," then you'd realize what a megalomaniac the character in that song really is. The judgmental bastard. The point is, there's no right answer, only the use that we can put the story to for our own benefit. So consider Sam Rice, Hall of Fame outfielder and a pretty common avatar example in this sort of discussion. He played for the Washington Senators. Unlike a lot of players, he even lived long enough to enjoy the experience of making it to Cooperstown. He had a long, strange, tragic trip to the majors, and he first came up as a pitcher after many adventures. And because of those delays, and because he was initially designated as someone whose best work would come on the mound, he didn't get started as a regular position player until he was nearly 30. And it turned out, once he did, that he was a great contact hitter who could knock out 300 in his sleep. And part of that was the period he played the center of his career in the 20s and 30s, but not everyone who played at that time could hit 320 every day. And so he got to play until he was 44 years old. He was primarily a right fielder, even though he had no power whatsoever. Part of that was down to the fact that Griffith Stadium in Washington was a pretty extreme pitcher's park. And part of that was by design, I think, in that the Senators recognized that they were playing in a pitcher's park with a big outfield. And so at their best, they had three center fielders. And if they hit like center fielders, so be it. And I don't mean the Mickey Mantle variety. I mean the Willie Wilson variety. Or for that matter, and here's a Senators standby, Clyde Deerfoot Milan, who I will get into just slightly more in a few minutes. The other thing, and I feel like I've mentioned this a few times lately, is that you can't really know if Sam Rice had no power. I mean, he hit 34 home runs in his career. And sure, that's a lot less than his contemporaries, even accounting for the park. But here's why I say you can't know. You can't just say, well, he played until 1934 and Babe Ruth played until 1935. And ballpark, they were the same age. Ruth was a little younger, I guess, and did very different things. And so obviously, Ruth had the 80 grade power and Rice had the 30 grade power, just hitting a bunch of doubles and triples every year. But the larger point is that Rice came up during the dead ball era, and it's pretty clear. Obviously, I don't have a film of him playing in front of me, but it's pretty clear that his swing was, as many players' swings were at that time, geared to generate ground balls. You're going to bounce the ball in the hard dirt. You're going to beat it out, Ichiro style. And then you're going to steal a base. You might bunt a lot, too. You might drag bunt for base hits. And you might sacrifice, as Rice did, 15 to 20 times a year. So you say, okay, well, he hit 1 to 3 home runs every season. His career high was actually 6, to be generous about it. That's kind of an outlier. The rest of the column is all 1s, 2s, and 3s. And a full 50% of those 34 home runs were of the inside-the-park variety, because not just Griffith Stadium, but the overall population of stadia was larger as well. And so they rewarded hitting the ball on the ground, because hitting a fly ball towards the fences wasn't going to get you anywhere. Rice, having good speed, could capitalize on it if he lined a ball into the gap, and then he could run all day. That's what accounts for some of those inside the park home runs, or all of them, probably. He hit at least a couple of those inside the park home runs at the New York ballparks against the Yankees. First, the Polo Grounds in 1922, where it was 500 feet to center field. Yes, the lines were very short, but if he got it past somebody into that back pasture and the ball rolled all the way back to that staircase going up to the clubhouse, obviously he might have been able to walk around the bases. If you look at a picture of Yankee Stadium when it first opened, not to be hyperbolic about it, but the fences were back in Times Square, especially in left center. My point in all this is to say that because the player's swing was geared in a certain way. You can't just translate his stats and say, well, if we league and park adjust them, his 350 would have gone down to 310 because batting averages are lower now, but he still wouldn't have hit any home runs, because it's impossible to know what he would have done if a modern coach or a modern baseball were presented to him, or both, and said, look, it's a little different now. Fences are in closer. Those gaps have been pulled in. And now if you lift the ball, it's going to go to outer space. So can you just try to hit up instead of down? And we see the effects of that kind of coaching all the time today. And I bring this up because it's a little sad to me that even though we have Sam Rice's baseball card and we know Sam Rice's story and we have pictures of Sam Rice, but in a real sense, he is completely lost to us. My favorite Sam Rice season, well, they're all kind of the same. He was very consistent. But in 1924, one of 2 years, really three, that the Senators won the pennant on his watch or during his career, I hesitate about the kind of three part, because when they hit the third one in 1933, he was 43 and was restricted to pinch hitting. But in 1924, when they won the pennant and the World Series, the only time that both happened, he played in every game, spent about half his time hitting leadoff and half the time hitting third. He hit .334 with a .382 on base and a .443 slugging percentage, stole 24 bases, struck out only 24 times while walking 46 times, led the league in hits with 216, the American League, that is, 39 doubles, 14 triples, one home run, drove in 76, scored 106. You could use that guy, even in right field. It's kind of Tony Gwynn-ish, if you think about it. Time goes on, he's released after that 1933 season, wants to play another year, why not? So he signs with Cleveland, again, why not, and plays about half the time at age 44 and hits .293. It's a light .293, but how many 44-year-olds do you know capable of hitting .293? How many 44-year-olds do you know who are capable of walking from the sofa to the refrigerator without effort? That's what I'd like to know. He finally retires after that campaign. There's not a lot further that you can go, especially when you're old enough to be the dad of your teammates, or maybe the granddad. Here's a note from September 1934, not long before Rice earned his final release, this one from Cleveland. I should have said that Walter Johnson was the manager at Cleveland, his longtime teammate. That no doubt helped in encouraging Cleveland to have Rice around. It says, Sam Rice, who has been performing in the American League since 1915, is one of the few players who still wears an old-fashioned nightshirt. Wee Winky Sam Rice runs through the town, upstairs and downstairs, in his nightgown, tapping at the window, crying at the lock. Are the players in their bed? For it's past 10 o'clock. Rice did not coach in the majors, so I don't know if he actually did any bed checks. But here's the thing. He hung them up with 2,987 hits, 13 short of the arbitrary but magical 3,000. Not magical to me. If I have 2,987 eggs, I'm pretty well fixed for eggs. There is no omelet that I can make that is going to require me to go out and bug the chickens for another baker's dozen worth of ovoids. But we know that human beings are like that, or not like that, I should say. I guess that makes me inhuman, to not care about big round numbers that don't come from nature, but just came about because someone said that it had to be that way. Now, maybe he skipped the last 13 because he had no choice, being 44. Maybe it was because, as Bill James once wrote, as of 1934, when Rice retired, no one cared about the number 3,000. And that's probably right to a certain extent. I'd be very curious when people did start to harp on that figure. I know Paul Wehner was aware of it when he reached that figure, because he talked about it and acted like it was important to him. And when he got hit 3,000 on a bobbled infield grounder, the official scorer said, hey, he would have beat it out anyway, even if the shortstop had fielded it cleanly. Wehner stood there on first base, yelling up the press box, saying, no, 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 no. He wanted that to be an error. He wanted the call to go against him because he wanted number 3,000 to be a clean hit. That was 1942, a scant 8 years after Sam Rice had retired. So it changed somewhere in there. Now, another thing I don't know, but is more salient to this story, is I would like to think that Sam Rice did not care. That if someone had said to him, hey, you can still pinch hit the odd single one more year, that he preferred to go home for the first time since 1915. When he left, he didn't have a home for reasons we'll discuss on another occasion. But by then he sure did, and he deserved to enjoy it. Look, if you have in your life, I don't know the total demographics of this audience. I have some guesses. I've met some of you. I've spoken to many others. If you in your life have aged from, say, 24 to 44, you know you don't feel the same at 44 as you did at 24. Not emotionally, not physically. We began with Granny Rice, and why is each the last to know? Oh, we know. Most of us know. They have reasons not to know. Athletes. But most of us, we are well aware that, as John Lennon said in Revolution Number 9, they all understood that as time went by, they'd get a little bit older and a little bit slower. And sulky about it. He didn't say that, but it's true. Unfortunately, he did not get to live long enough to find out. But I would like to think that if some 1934 bean counter said, 13 more, Sam, he might have said, going home. Want to sleep in my own bed year round. You mind? You have a problem with that? Do you really insist that I've got to do more? And if he did, if he said anything like that or thought it, why would you disagree with that? Why would anyone sweat something so arbitrary? And the answer comes back down the ages because you're a selfish egomaniac, because you're Pete Rose. That's exactly the kind of thing that I'm not endorsing. I am celebrating Sam Rice being the opposite of that. Now, I want to talk about a player who did try to chase something arbitrary, and we'll do that when? Right after this brief intermission. One more quick note about Rice, leaving out his origin story for the time being. We'll do that another time. There's a story about him moving from the mound to the outfield. As I said, like Babe Ruth, he came up as a pitcher. It's not perfectly true, if you check it, but it's just about true, and I like it, so I'm going to tell you about it very quickly. On June 4th, 1916, Rice came on in relief in a game against the Tigers at Detroit. This was his first full season in the majors. He had come up briefly in 1915. 1916, he was on the Senators pitching staff for good. The game was tied 3-3 going to the bottom of the ninth. Rice came on and retired the first batter on a line drive to center, but the next batter reached when third baseman Eddie Foster booted his ground ball. That brought up pitcher Hooks Doss, also in the game as a reliever. It's 1915 or 1916, as I said. Not automatic pinch hitting for the pitcher in that spot. You don't have so many of them. And Doss wasn't the worst ever hitting pitcher, but he wasn't Red Ruffing or Wes Farrell or anyone. He hit 189 in a long career and had 6 home runs. So he wasn't an automatic out, just well below par. I don't know if anyone at Sabre or anywhere else has done a study of just how often and when dead ball era managers pinch hit for the pitcher. Not that often. But then you didn't get into relief pitchers that often either. You'd think you would, but again, you might have an 8-man pitching staff, so you don't have that many choices. You've got to keep Hooks Doss in the game. Well, Rice threw one down the middle. He grooved it, the paper said, showing just how long that term has been in usage. And Doss hit it all the way to the wall. The runner scored easily, and Doss made it to third. Rice, as you would imagine, was upset about this and said, I'm no pitcher if Doss can hit me for 2, even though it was 3, and grabbed a knife and cut the pitcher's toe plate off of his shoes, which must have been quite a relief to his teammates because there are any number of other branching possibilities that come after the decision to grab a knife. You should have caught that ball on guard, you fiend! Having mutilated his shoes, he said, "Give me another glove, 'cause now I'm an outfielder." His pitching career actually had 2 games to go at that point, so he probably slipped off the mound a lot without his toe plate. Both of those games were pretty bad. He allowed 8 runs in 13 and a third innings. But after that, he really was done with pitching and was an outfielder for good, never threw another pitch in anger. And even better, he was an outfielder who knew better than to hang around and try to get another 13 hits to satisfy the opinions of people he would never know and would never know him. And now, let's briefly consider the opposite. Early win of Alabama, home of the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. I confess, I have a hard time getting excited about early win, and I think the reason why I find myself automatically bored by him is the same reason I'm bored when a TV series introduces a heretofore unknown young male whose father can only be the protagonist. Because if his father was a salesman who happened by one day when the protagonist was out, well, okay, I guess that would be kind of interesting. But it's never that kind of domestic betrayal setup. It's always that the protagonist had met the mother figure back in episode 13. They had a one-night stand, and then there were 3 more seasons and maybe a reunion film, and this kid was never mentioned, but now it turns out that he's the dad. Whereas if you just told it the way that life happens, which is to say, yes, we had this fling back in episode 13 in 1974, and then my life went on, and I met somebody, and we were married for a while, and then we were divorced, and then we got back together, we had some hookups, and anyway, we had this kid out of it, and then the protagonist would have no obligation towards the kid at all. So when it turned out that the kid had fallen into a life of crime or had been kidnapped by terrorists or something, he would have no obligation to bestir himself to go fetch that kid, but only to say, "Oh, that's too bad." I hate that story because it's inevitable. And a story that's inevitable is a failure because delight comes from surprise. There really was a monster on the wing. Oh no. If you already know the story before you pick up the remote, why do you need to watch it? And that's early win and 300 pitching wins. His Hall of Fame plaque leads with that, winner of 300 major league games. What else do we know about early win? Well, he liked to pitch inside. That is inevitably what comes next. Won 300 games, was a mean, nasty headhunter, but he wasn't. He didn't hit that many batters, actually. He hit 64 in 23 years, 3 a season. Don Drysdale, who also had the reputation of a headhunter, hit 154 in 11 years and led the National League 5 times. Wynn, who spent his whole career in the AL, never led in that category. He's the guy who was asked if he would knock down his mother, and he answered that it depended if she were digging in or if she were on a hitting streak at the time, which are fun answers. "Every hitter I face is a man trying to take money out of my pocket," he said. "Every hitter is my enemy." And I'm sure he felt that way on the mound, but he felt it within reason and within the boundaries of decency in baseball. Late in his career, he liked to joke about dusting off his own son when the kid hit a homer off of him in the backyard, but he admitted that that wasn't true. It was just part of his mystique, which is to say that he wanted the batter to think he might hurt them rather than his being an actual sadist. Actual sadists do not get to pitch nearly a quarter of a century in the major leagues. He once said, by way of diffusing his reputation, I think, that if he had really wanted to hurt batters, he'd stick it in his ribs. A batter can't move his body as quick as he moves his head. There's a pro tip for you. But again, he didn't hit that many pitchers. Excuse me, batters. 3 a year. That could be 3, oops. The early win basics. Wynn Jr., that was his name, his dad was Early Wynn Sr., was born in 1920 in Hartford, Alabama. At the risk of being uncharitable to what is probably a perfectly lovely place, even today, it looks like it's in the middle of nowhere. not too far north of the border with Florida, the long border with Florida. Looking it up on a map, I was immediately reminded of pitcher Ed Morris, who we discussed back, I think, in episode 114, a guy who was murdered at his own spring training going away party in 1932. And I imagine those who were generous enough to cook up dishes for the potluck supper were kind of disappointed that the purpose of the party had been completely, totally, and permanently thwarted. Has Ed left yet? No, he hasn't left. Is he going to leave? No, Bob, he is never going to leave. In fact, he is never going to leave anywhere, ever again. All right, but he did get to try my wife's goulash before he died, right? You know how sensitive Edna is about her goulash. Lot of paprika in goulash, Bob. Well, what of it? Big Ed was allergic to paprika. Well, it can't hurt him any now, can it? Well, no, not with a knife sticking out of his liver, no, but before that. And then Natasha Lyonne inexplicably shows up. That happened, well, all of it except the Natasha part, in Century, Florida, which is just south of the border, as Hartford is north of it, albeit about 100 miles to the east. At 17, Edwin, the radio star, the guy who said, "Don't you know," a lot, early Win, went to a tryout camp run by the Senators and was signed by former big league outfielder, I told you he'd be back, Clyde Deerfoot Milan. Good player, Clyde. He's not really remembered today because, well, he was a long time ago. He spent his whole career with the Senators. The Senators are dead too. And he himself literally died as a Senator, incurring a fatal coronary while hitting fungos during spring training in 1953. But it's kind of fun to look at Clyde's baseball card because he was the kind of center fielder who doesn't presently exist. The kind who slaps some singles, walks, steals 40 or 50 bases. I imagine he'd be worth about $30 million a year right now. He shows off his baseball perspicacity and signs this kid who immediately drops out of high school and heads for the minor leagues because back then a mind was an okay thing to waste. I was looking for a piece I wrote at Baseball Prospectus this week on the majors, or Major League Baseball, I should say, the corporation trying to get minor leaguers cut out of minimum wage pay in various places in the country. I took a moment to be inspired by the turn of the 20th century, a little later than that, 19-teens, let's say, photographs by Lewis Hine, who was half an artistic photographer and half a social worker, and he went around to the cotton fields and the cranberry bogs and the textile mills and took pictures of all of these sooty little children who were put to work in these factories, sometimes because of their very diminutive stature, allowed them to fit into places that adults could not. And he also took pictures of, say, their occasionally missing fingers that had been chawed off by some kind of machine. Very few people turn into Three Finger Brown at that point. All his pictures are in the Library of Congress. If you Google Lewis Hine, you will get a link to their site, and I recommend it. There is a great picture he took, too. It didn't come up for me yesterday, but of New York City kids, or maybe it was Boston. I correct myself. Boston kids playing baseball in an alley, in a tenement alley with laundry strung above them. That's really evocative in a good way, not in the, oh my gosh, I can't believe we permitted this as a society, feeding children into the Industrial Revolution, but just, hey, look, baseball grows up in the most unlikely of places. It shoots up like a weed and allows kids an escape from their circumstances, or at least a momentary relief from their immiseration. And actually, there are some other pictures from, I believe, the textile mills when the kids were at lunch. And what did they do at lunch when they were permitted a little break? They played baseball. And early Win wasn't too different from that either. He worked as a child because that's what you did at that time. And again, if you look at the map and ask yourself, well, what was going on in Hartford, Alabama, about 1930, you will be forced to concede not a whole lot that allows for the kind of rewards that Early Win got from pitching in the major leagues for roughly 25 years. He first reached the major leagues at a raw 19, was sent back down for a couple of years of additional seasoning, sans paprika, and came to the majors permanently in September of 1941 when he pitched quite well. He was, however, very inconsistent with the Senators over the next 8 years, minus one plus for the war. Some of those wartime Senators teams were pretty good and Wynn was pretty good for them, but at other times in other seasons, he was just thrashed. And some of that may have been that it was a franchise that was very much either feast or famine, and increasingly the latter as time went by, as they invested neither in integration nor in a minor league system. They were pioneers on Cuba, which is kind of ironic, but not those other two things, and they became alienated from their fan base, particularly as, you will pardon the expression, the complexion of Washington, D.C. continued to evolve, and they could not find, did not want to find, under Clark Griffith's successor, common ground with that audience. And so the franchise withered. In 1948, Wynn went 8-19 with a 5.82 ERA. That is as bad as it sounds. This after having been an all-star the year before. Sometimes that just happens to pitchers, but it cooked him with the Senators at the age of 28, and they dealt him off to Cleveland with another franchise standard bearer, Mickey Vernon, for three players who would not still be pitching 14 years later, as Wynn was, or at least was trying to. That team, that Cleveland team, was quite good at the time, and it could give him better support from the rest of the roster and also better coaching via pitching coach Mel Harder. Wynn was far better, far more consistent for Cleveland, and his record with the team is still one of the best in its history. Over 10 years, he went 164-102. With a 3.24 ERA, led the American League in wins twice, ERA once, innings pitched three times, strikeouts twice, and picked up the 1959 Cy Young Award. He was a five-time 20-game winner. He was part of the great Cleveland rotation that won 111 games in 1954. On the downside, like a lot of 1950s pitchers, he also walked a ton of guys, and despite his bulldog attitude and good stuff, he must have been kind of tedious to watch at times. In addition to the inevitable inside fastball, he threw a curve, a slider, and used a knuckleball as a changeup very effectively. Those off-speed pitches came via Harder's tutelage, in part because he pitched for so many years, in part because of the times, in part because of his wildness. He retired as the all-time leader in walks issued, a title he held until Nolan Ryan came along. He still ranks fourth. Can you guess the other two on the list? I will not make you wait more than a heartbeat. The other two, the two that come between Nolan Ryan and early Wynn, Steve Carlton and Phil Niekro. He was also, Mr. Wynn, a pretty good hitter for a pitcher, and once pinch hit a grand slam and then stayed in the game as a pitcher and got the win, which is pretty cool and kind of unusual. As I said earlier, Wynn lost a year and a half or so to military service in World War II, which was more or less the reason he ended 1961, his age 41 season, with 292 wins. Heck, it's also the reason Sam Rice's hit total finished where it did, not just because he got a late start, but because he also missed just about all of 1918 after being drafted, and then, although he played every game in 1919, that was a truncated season again due to the war, as the major leagues waited to give men time to be demobbed. Or did they say demobbed? I don't really know. I've only seen it written out. Demobilized is the word that we're looking for. That should have been good enough for anyone, even Hall of Fame voters. But was it good enough for early Wynn? It was not. Wynn won game number 299 on September 8th, 1963, with a chunk of the season left to go, but he couldn't seal the deal in three more starts, getting creamed each time. In a sense, his failure was on manager Al Lopez, who, in his final chance, kept him in the game too long. Wynn had a 3-1 lead with two outs in the bottom of the seventh at Yankee Stadium, but then the old guy gave up a double to Clete Boyer. The next batter was pinch hitter Joe Pepitone, lefty power hitter. Today, no doubt a lefty pitcher would be coming into the game at that point, but Lopez left Wynn in and Pepitone hit one out. Now it was 3-3, Wynn got the last out of the inning, and came back out for the eighth because it's no longer a Wynn situation. He again got two outs, But then Roger Maris doubled, Tony Kubek singled, Yogi Berra singled, and Dale Long hit a three-run homer, 7-3 Yankees. The White Sox, for whom Wynn had been part of the 1959 World Series team, released him after that. But they invited him back for spring training in 1963. His early appearances were not good. He wasn't throwing very hard, and he didn't throw any breaking pitches either. Maybe he needs a little more time, said Lopez. Well, they cut him at the end of spring training, and Early, having no pressing offers, went home for a while. He wanted to keep going, he said, for pride, not for the winning effort, not for the team, whichever team chose to sign him, but for his own stats. As it was, he had pitched longer in terms of years than anyone in history to that point. Much like Sam Rice, he had had his chances. A few teams knocked, but no one actually signed him. Finally, at the beginning of June, Gabe Paul of Cleveland, a general manager who really liked an aging gate attraction, made the final call. Cleveland wasn't going anywhere in particular that year, but their starting pitching was pretty thin, so why not fill it out with someone who has a goal, who has a dream? They did have a number of good pitchers on hand, including Tommy John and Sam McDowell, but both were only 20 years old and a while away from their peak. John, of course, would be thrown away to bring Rocky Colavito back to Cleveland, but that's another story. Their staff was kind of like the World War II song. They're either too young or too old. John and McDowell were, at that point, in the too young part of the ballgame. Wynn spent a few weeks getting back into game shape and made his return to the mound on June 21st, 1963. He pitched a complete game, allowed only two runs, but Cleveland was shut out by Juan Pizarro. He made two more starts and a relief appearance, all of them pretty good, but it wasn't until his fifth game back, July 13th, second game of a doubleheader against the lowly A's, that he finally was credited with a win. He didn't pitch well that day, and Lopez had to hook him early, for which Wynn was thankful. He said he was all in, but he got the run support, the bullpen held on, and he won his 300th game by a score of 7-4. He made it on his seventh try. And if you want to hear something kind of insane, Tony La Russa played in that game. At that point, manager Bertie Tebbets, the old catcher, shoved Wynn well back into the bullpen. He only made one more start. He wasn't terrible. He pitched 27 and a third innings, pretty much all in games Cleveland was already trailing, so it was trash time relief, but he had a 1.65 ERA in those games. He was almost prohibited by that usage pattern of ever winning another game, and he didn't. His final career record was 300-244. It still is. His ERA was 3.54, and a little later that year, John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and then the Beatles came. That doesn't have anything to do with early Wynn, but I'm on a roll. When Wynn finally got to 300, becoming at that point only the 14th pitcher ever to get there, the Cleveland Plain Dealer gave the story a war-declared headline, and I'm not really sure why. When Wynn went into the Hall of Fame, he was one of a class of eight, large class, obviously. The others were Yogi Berra, Sandy Koufax, Buck Leonard, Lefty Gomez, and three men who were no longer breathing, Ross Youngs, Josh Gibson, and former AL president Will Harridge. Of the seven players, putting Harridge aside, Wynn was probably a better pitcher than Gomez, but much less memorable, and a better player on a career basis certainly than Youngs, who didn't even get in a full 10 years due to the kidney disease that killed him at mid-career. Yogi and Josh Gibson were obviously two of the greatest catchers in history, and orders of magnitude better than almost all of them. You could say the same thing about Sandy Koufax for his relatively brief period of health. And Buck Leonard might have been the greatest first baseman in the history of the Negro Leagues. I mean, his statistics are, his baseball card is covered in black ink, leading the league in batting average a couple of times and on base percentage just about every year he was healthy, and slugging three times. And they called him the Black Lou Gehrig. And whether you consider that appropriate or not, because maybe Lou Gehrig was the white him, or maybe we shouldn't be characterizing players by race at all, but they were both ridiculously good. And it was no insult to either of them to be compared to each other, because they were both just amazing hitters. And Leonard may well have been the superior fielder. He was supposedly excellent. No one really ever said that about Gehrig. They didn't think he was bad or anything, but he was certainly more of a hitter than a fielder. With Buck Leonard, they sang the praises of his glove work around the bag for the entirety of his long career. So does any of that excite you? I'm not saying that early wins should or shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. I don't care about that. And you know that if you've listened to this show for more than a nanosecond over the years. I'm just asking, do you feel differently about early win because he struggled over the course of about 10 months, including an offseason, to get this accounting mark on the back of his baseball card? If it meant something to him, then I'm happy for him. I'm happy for any kids he had who are still around, any grandkids. But what was cool about early win was that he was a really good pitcher, the kind of pitcher who could say, and he did this in 1959, one hit the Red Sox with 14 strikeouts. Yeah, he also walked seven. That's just how he was. He never did throw a no-hitter. But in addition to that one hitter, he had seven two-hitters. You can't say that about just any pitcher in the history of the major leagues. In fact, I'll give you the whole list of pitchers you can say that about. Nolan Ryan, Walter Johnson, Bob Feller, Addy Joss, Christy Mathewson, Jim Maloney, Jim Palmer, Wild Bill Donovan, Phil Niekro, Tom Seaver, and Early Win. That's it. That is a very special group to belong to. The totality of it, of Wynn's career, I mean, is a testament to stick-to-itiveness. But on an individual basis, all the glory and wonderfulness and, well, marshmallow filling sandwiched between two graham crackers and wrapped in a chocolate envelope is contained in those individual games. The one-hitters and two-hitters and obviously just your run-of-the-mill seven-hit, one-run game, of which I'm sure he had a ton as well. I mean, you don't win 300 games without being able to do that on a consistent basis. We should be able to appreciate that, whether the baseball card says 300 or 299 and 23 years in the majors. They don't keep you for over two decades just because they like your company. Wynn, who did a lot of after-dinner speaking back when players spent their off-seasons doing that, once said, "Distance in time leads to enchantment." I think he meant that his career would get prettier the further away from it we get. I feel like several relationships of mine bear out the truth of his statement. Up close and personal right now, pretty bad, but rendered gauzy, hazy by the passage of 5 or 10 or more years and 1,000 miles, not just in physical distance, but in emotional distance, sure, they seem great. I remember all the good times, only the good times. So bring them back, bring them on, I'm ready. But you know, and I know, that that's a lie, right? A lie that I'm telling myself, because the sand that has run through the hourglass, you can't recapture it. That moment, that beautiful moment that we had together, that you and they had together. I'm being general. I'm not referring to any specific person. I could be referring to dozens of people that I've known in my life and any of 1,000 moments we shared. That day that she and I played catch in the park, and I thought, well, I could do this the rest of my life. If we could just freeze the film right here on this boy and girl playing catch in the park, I would understand what happiness is. But the totality of that relationship outside of that frozen moment? No, 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 no. What a nightmare. All my fault. I take all the responsibility at this late date. I was immature. Judging the whole of 2 years of my life by that moment in the park would be delusional, which is why time and distance don't do anything to enchant early wins quest for 300, because the arrival is not at all enchanting. The game was sloppy. The quest was interminable. And just like my romantic moment in the park, his best moments, his enchanting moments were in the park too. That day at Cleveland Municipal Stadium, that afternoon at Yankee Stadium, that evening at Tiger Stadium, when he got strike three on that unexpected knuckleball. The rest was just self-serving, and we don't need it. And the sad part is, just like Sam Rice and his missing 13 hits, neither did Early. At long last, I have completed another episode of The Infinite Inning after a vacation, yet another health scare. I hope you're all out there. I hope you are still with me because the show is back and so am I. For however long I can keep ducking these bullets, you can follow me on Twitter at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because I'm going to go on producing episodes of The Infinite Inning. I do admit I am so disgusted by the present environment on that site that I've been saying very little, but I'm still there. I'm lurking. You can write us, by which I mean me, at infiniteinning@gmail.com. And there's a Facebook group. Simply go to Facebook, search on Infinite Inning. Bang, you're there. Find pictures, links, and whatever the heck we feel like talking about. How about a little chatter out there? Should you wish to support the show, and I very much hope you do, please visit patreon.com/theinfiniteinning. Gear of a rudimentary kind, available at teespring.com/stores/the-infinite-inning. Original soundtrack, available at casualobservermusic.bandcamp.com. And finally, should you find yourself with the proverbial moment to spare, please go to the podcatcher of your choice and rate, review, and subscribe. And if your podcatcher doesn't let you do those things, please go to the podcatcher of your choice and rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps. Try to find a way. Our theme song, which you are hearing now and have been listening to throughout the episode, was a co-composition of myself and Dr. Rick Mooring, who reminds you that nothing good comes from wrestling with your ghosts, nor anyone else's, especially the latter. Avoid supernatural pugilism at all costs. Well, we're back. What else is there to say? I will return next week with more tales from inside the Infinite Inning.